This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Last time, we've been talking about heart and essentially things that are related to the heart. I've actually talked to you about little pump that could, essentially two elements of the heart physiology. Electronic element, which is essentially that thing that we measure with ECG, which is actually governing the heart activity, and then mechanical part of the heart work, which is actually concerned with pumping, with actually generating the force that generates pressure and moves the blood through the plumbing. We also sort of said that roughly you can divide heart problems in two sets of general sets of problems: electrical problems, problems with conduction or generation of electrical impulses, and mechanical problems, problems in generating force. Someone at the very end actually asked me, have you ever heard of diastolic heart failure? What does that mean? And we actually defined last time systole and diastole. Systole is essentially that time when the heart is actually actively contracting. And diastole is the time when the heart is actually relaxing. And since that person actually asked about this, I actually felt maybe I should share it with all of you. There is indeed diastolic heart failure as well, just as systolic heart failure. Systolic heart failure is that one in which your heart cannot generate enough force to pump the blood. Now, if you remember, I told you that actually relaxation of the heart is also an active process. It's not that just heart relax because it's not contracting. We don't know as much as we wish to know about relaxation and why and how active it is. But it turns out that it is an active process and it relaxes actively. So what typically happens with diastolic heart failure is actually that your heart, failing heart, fails to relax properly. So if it doesn't relax properly, that means that actually you have extra pressure inside of that heart. Would you appreciate that? You wouldn't appreciate it, but it's a fact. So we wouldn't want to go there with our own hearts, but that's what happens. So that actually requires those atria to generate more pressure and venous system to generate more pressure in order to bring more blood to the heart so that heart can generate appropriate cardiac output. So that's about diastolic heart failure. We also actually said that what heart really is concerned about is generating flow. How does body measure flow? We actually don't have very nice systems to measure flow in our body. So we use as a proxy, essentially, our body uses as a proxy pressure measurements. So it's actually measuring mean arterial pressure, which is going to be in a big part topic of what we are going to be talking about. So it's essentially heart generates the flow in order to perfuse the tissues, and it generates that flow by generating pressure, and that driving pressure is what it does. And then the blood goes through these various vascular elements of the cardiovascular system. So if we go and take a look at the systemic circulation, starting from the left ventricle and ending in the left atrium, right atrium, I apologize. So we have actually arteries here, right here. We have arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins. And those are essentially vascular elements of the cardiovascular system. So today, what we're going to be doing is mostly talking about these. However, I figured actually that it wouldn't be quite nice just to leave you like, well, there's heart, and then there's blood vessels. Heart pumps, blood vessels convey the blood. It's just plumbing. I decided that in the end we talk a little bit about also about regulation of this system. Because when we talk about cardiovascular system, we are actually talking about an integrated system that is constantly adjusting the flow, constantly moving blood from one place to another, moving from one capillary bed to another. And in order to do that, does anybody here have an engineering degree? There are a couple of people, three, four. So if you were an engineer and you want to design a system in which you want actually to keep that system that you are designing to do something within a certain specified limits so that it doesn't have too many oscillations up or down. So what do you need to do actually to, how would you conceptually go about designing a system? Yes, please.
Feedback
loops, and that's essentially what happens in the cardiovascular system. And generally, do you remember when I was talking to you about homeostasis? That's actually what engineers actually know what homeostasis is, although they may do it in a relatively simpler systems. But homeostasis really means keeping your whatever parameter within the certain limits, not letting it go too high or too low. If you're going to do that, then you're going to have certain requirements for that system. You're going to have some sensors that are going to be telling you what's happening with the system and a few other things. And this is how most of our things in our body work, on this negative feedback loops, so-called negative feedback loops. So we're going to be talking about physiology of the vascular system and the regulation of arterial pressure. As I told you, regulation of arterial pressure as a proxy for the regulation of the flow or perfusion of tissues. So these are the things that essentially are objectives. At the same time, these are the kernels of things that actually I would like you to, at some point, 50 years down the road, if you remember these things, I'd be extremely happy. Well, you'll be around. So, arteries are high pressure and low volume reservoir. I'm going to actually tell you what I mean when I say that. They convert pulsatile flow to steady flow. Arterioles regulate flow into capillary beds. Capillaries are the site of exchange with tissues, which is essentially business end of the system, where the actual things happen, other than plumbing. Veins are low pressure, high volume reservoir, and they can regulate cardiac filling. Flow to critical organs and tissues is monitored and regulated through mean arterial pressure. So those are the things that we're going to be covering. So let's take a look at the arteries. As I said, arteries are high pressure. Low volume reservoir. We usually don't think of them in that way, but in essence, that's what they are. This is actually a figure from an old grades anatomy textbook, so I just use it because I kind of like it. Illustrates just a bunch of systemic arteries. But the thing is, what do I mean when I say that arteries are high pressure and low volume reservoir? As you know, heart pumps the blood and generates the pressure. And the first place where that blood is going to go is arteries. And the highest pressure that is going to be actually generated in any part of the vascular system is going to be in the arteries. So they are, by definition, high pressure. Why are they low volume? At any given time, there's maybe like 20% or so blood in arteries. Not very much. Why would I call it a reservoir? Reservoir is usually something there that denotes some kind of reserve sort of something. Reservoir of I don't know, fresh water is Hetch Hetchy for San Francisco. So How are the arteries reservoir? Well, they are reservoir that is actually dipped and taken in, dipped in only under really high dangerous conditions when you start bleeding and you need to quickly redirect blood to the brain and the heart in order to survive. So essentially, that's what I mean, high pressure and a low volume reservoir. They can't, it won't last long as a reservoir, but it'll actually carry you until these other systems kick in. So when we think about this ventricular contraction we talked about last time, take a look at this, guys. Remember, ventricular diastole pressures are very, very low. Why are the pressures during ventricular diastole this low, very low? What you need to have is pressure low in the ventricle in order to pressure in the veins that are bringing the blood in the ventricle can be higher than the pressure in the ventricle so that you can feel the ventricle. And then ventricle contracts and you actually have very high pressures in the ventricle. So ventricular difference between systolic and diastolic pressure is huge, around 120 millimeters of mercury. So this whole thing here, if you will, if I actually extrapolate what would be ventricular pressure right here. So this is difference in ventricle between diastolic and systolic pressure. Do you see that? So this is a huge oscillation. Wouldn't you agree with me? It's a huge oscillation. If imagine if we actually walked like this actually and our blood was pulsing like that in our whole vascular system. You would actually be walking and dropping and losing consciousness all the time. That would be a really poorly designed system. We can see actually that in arteries, which is, do you see that blue line up there just above the ventricle? So that actually indicates arteries. So I'm going to choose the arterial color now and actually show you that what is actually oscillation in the arteries between systolic and diastolic pressure. Do you see how much smaller oscillation there is? We eliminated practically 3/4 of oscillations of the ventricular pressures just by arteries. Arteries themselves essentially are converting this pulsatile flow into much more smooth flow. And there is the answer to Bill's question, actually, if we had just regular garden variety copper tube attached to the heart, why the flow wouldn't be that very, why the heart couldn't supply actually really the energy and flow throughout the system if it were all copper tubes. So take a look at this. This is actually what happens during diastole in the heart. We have, let's say this is very simple drawing. Do you like my drawing? So these are AV valves. Do you see those, the yellow ones, that are dipping down into the ventricle? This is the left ventricle, only one ventricle, only left ventricle. You have left atrium, which is actually cut off. This is arrow pointing the flow of the blood into the ventricle. And we have aortic valves right here closed. Yes? So the question that Bill is asking, wouldn't it make sense actually because the right heart is pumping towards the left heart, that the right heart pumps first and then that blood goes into the left heart and then left heart pumps? Because I actually told you, I was trying to convince you that these are two separate pumps and two separate systems. Well, the thing is that at any given time, your system, whole system is filled with blood. Do you see now why that works? So if your whole system is filled with blood, then there's no need to wait for things to move. When I'm pushing this thing is pushing things in front of it and pushing things in front of it, so essentially contraction is actually more or less uniform.
Well, if they work at the same time.
Yes.
Instantaneous, and they're both squeezing. So the pulmonary system is trying to inject blood into the left ventricle at the same time it's squeezing and trying to keep it out.
Ah, it doesn't work quite like that. The reason why it doesn't work quite like that, and actually that's why we're here now to talk about vascular system, is because the vascular system has some compliance. So it accepts this blood flow, elevates the pressure, and then just continues driving. And if you take a look at this, what is going to be happening here, this may actually simplify the answer to that question as well. So we have left ventricle right here, and we have aorta, chunk of aorta that I actually drew. And the pressures in the left ventricle may be 0 to 3 millimeters of mercury or to 5, thereabouts. So I'm not actually going to be very precise about this, but this is actually a ballpark figure. So blood is coming into the ventricle. At the same time, actually, just before the contraction of the right ventricle, we have 80 millimeters of mercury in the aorta. So what is diastolic pressure? If I were to ask you, what would you tell me, guys?
It's the last beat. I mean, when you're taking blood pressure, it's the last sound. It's like the pressure at the last.
Pressure at the last moment, just before the aortic valve opens, and it opens because the heart has contracted. Now, that's a perfectly good answer to the question, what is arterial diastolic pressure? I didn't ask arterial, I asked general question, what is diastolic pressure? And actually, obviously, there are two different diastolic pressures. One is for the heart, which is what you see here, and one is for the vascular system, which is what you see here. And then pulmonary system would actually have a slightly lower diastolic pressure than systemic circulation. It would be around 8 millimeters of mercury. So, but one thing to remember is that diastolic pressure really means the lowest pressure in the system in a single cardiac cycle. It could be the lowest pressure in the aorta or arteries during single cardiac cycle, or the lowest pressure in the ventricle during single cardiac cycle. So what is single cardiac cycle? Does anybody care to tell me, or do you know? Diastole, I'm feeling. Systole, I've squeezed what I feel down, and then diastole again. So that's one single cardiac cycle. Yes? But that was measured here. Yeah, you can measure it here, or you can actually go into the heart and measure what's happening in the heart. That's a little bit more aggressive measurement of the blood pressure. It's not typically done in your regular checkup, yearly checkup in the doctor's office. But does this make sense, guys? So let's contract this heart. You see what happens? Because of the pressure increase to 120 millimeters of mercury, as actually this doesn't happen like I showed you right here, like this. Pressure, this heart starts contracting and pressure is building up until it actually opens up aortic valve. As soon as the heart actually starts contracting, it builds enough pressure to close this mitral valve so that there is no backflow in the atria. If you have any backflow in the atria, you have insufficiency of AV valve, so that's a problem. So what happens then is actually blood goes and flows into the aorta and the rest of the system. That makes sense, does it? But take a look what happened to the aorta. Gets very big. I mean, I'm a bit exaggerated. But this is actually what does happen to aorta. Actually, do you know, by the way, does anybody know what is the call, how do we call the volume that heart pumps in one single cycle? Mark, see you, Mark?
Yes. Cardiac output.
Cardiac output actually takes in number of these over unit of time, over minute. Stroke volume, it's called stroke volume. Single stroke means single amount of volume of blood per one single cycle. Okay, so that stroke volume can't all go away because the aorta is fairly narrow, even though it's a big, it's not that big blood vessel. So it turns out that we actually lose this way only about 25% of blood goes out of the arteries during the single contraction of the ventricle, which means that the other 75% has to be stored in arteries. Do you see that? And therein lies the answer why the copper tube would be actually really bad and heart couldn't do it if you had copper tubes. And that's actually part of the problem with atherosclerosis. In atherosclerosis, you can have calcification of your arteries, of your aorta, for example, and it can't actually distend. You need your arteries to be elastic. And as a matter of fact, what is systolic pressure? We know this is the maximum pressure that is reached in the system, either in the heart or in the arteries during single cardiac cycle. Systolic minus diastolic pressure is the pulse pressure, and actually for the heart it's a different value relative to the arteries. This is the answer to what happens and why can we actually do this? Why do our arteries actually distend? If you take a look at this, this is aorta right here. Take a look at actually what is aorta actually comprising of. The wall of the aorta. Endothelial cells. Endothelial cells you're going to see across the whole system. Every single blood vessel has endothelial cell. Those are those nice little cells, smooth, thin cells that line up the inside of the blood vessel. But take a look at the other stuff. I have this later on as well. So if you want to take a picture, take it, but we'll come back to this. Take a look at the elastic fibers. Aorta has huge amount of elastic fibers, and so do medium arteries and even arterioles. These elastic fibers are essentially like springs that heart, jamming the blood into arteries, loads up. And then once the heart is actually relaxing, you have slow squeeze of the arteries, of the blood, downstream. Does it make sense? So the 75% of the blood that heart actually jammed into the arteries is actually flowing downstream after the heart already started relaxing. Pretty remarkable, isn't it? And a beautiful system. So you need your arteries to be elastic. You need them to be young. So, I'm going to show you this whole thing actually a little bit more sped up. The same thing. So, diastole, systole, and then slowly flowing down. That's what happens. Does it make sense, guys? So a lot of this energy that actually heart gives into blood that is actually going to go into arteries is actually stored in these elastic fibers. So, given that we actually have these huge oscillations of pressure between systolic, which is maximum, let's say in someone who is very healthy, well, or I don't know, all these numbers were done a long time ago on male medical students. As they were actually guinea pigs in these experiments. So 120 over 80. So mean arterial pressure is actually the driving pressure. We don't have, neither 120 nor 80 can be the driving pressure because it's pressure in one moment in time only. So what we do have is actually, in order to calculate what is actually the driving pressure, we need to have some kind of weighted average of these pressures on arterial side. So that weighted average we call mean arterial pressure. And if I draw, just remember that blue line, guys, on that, what I was just pointing out to you, and I was showing you how we have this oscillation between the systolic and diastolic pressure in the arteries. So that blue line is now yellow line, I apologize. But it doesn't show well blue on blue. So I change the colors. So this would be that mean arterial pressure. It's weighted average of the pressures between the systolic and diastolic. Turns out that actually, if we are resting, heart spends one-third of the time of the cycle in systole and two-thirds of the time in diastole. So that pressure is weighted towards diastolic pressures. So mean arterial pressure is then going to be closer to your diastolic pressures than this maximum systolic pressure. So if you remember back to the last lecture and last time we talked about essentially the fact that beginning of the systemic circulation, and I'm going to talk about systemic circulation, this whole thing is true, absolutely true for the pulmonary system, except that pressures are different. Pressures are much smaller. I said that systemic circulation, for all practical purposes, begins with left ventricle and ends up with the right atrium. Which means that driving pressure is going to be pressure difference between the left ventricle and right atrium. However, because left ventricle oscillates so much, we actually, what we use is that mean arterial pressure, which is actually aortic and arterial pressure. So when we are looking what the driving pressure really is, we are looking at the mean arterial pressure versus the pressure in the right atrium, the end of systemic circulation. Does anybody remember what I said about the pressure in the right atrium? What the numbers are there? Really low, close to zero. So for all practical purposes, let's call it zero. Because it simplifies our life. Although it's kind of like 2, 3, 4, thereabouts. So that means the driving pressure is going to be mean arterial pressure minus pressure in the right atrium. And if we say that pressure in the right atrium approximates zero, we can say that actually mean arterial pressure really approximate the driving pressure. So mean arterial pressure, for all practical purposes, we can call it the driving pressure. Essentially, that pressure that heart generates in order to overcome the resistance of the systemic circulation so that blood can go back to the right atrium. That's a very interesting thing that I said, actually, resistance. Remember this formula? This is formula that tells us what the flow is. Q stands for flow. Delta P here is actually driving pressure. Pressure difference between the beginning of the system and the end of the system. What did we say then for systemic circulation the driving pressure is? Anybody wants to say something very obvious that is written up on there? It's the mean arterial pressure. Since we said that pressure in the right atrium is almost zero, so that delta P is actually mean arterial pressure minus zero, which actually equals mean arterial pressure. So this is how we can write that expression now. And I told you actually that our system is set up not to measure flow. It's actually not easy to measure flow. Engineers who are actually doing the mechanics of fluid know that flow, to measure flow is a little bit harder than to measure pressures. So what our system is really concerned typically with is mean arterial pressure. So I'm going to give you the formula, just rearranging this for mean arterial pressure. So mean arterial pressure is product of CO. Now CO, now I replaced Q. Q is flow. And CO is actually a special kind of flow. Mark mentioned that flow moments ago. It's cardiac output. Cardiac output. So how do we measure flow, guys? Some unit of volume over some unit of time. In this case, liters per minute is typically what we use for cardiac output. And then we have SVR stands there for systemic vascular resistance. R is resistance in this formula. SVR is systemic vascular resistance, which means actually resistance all that total resistance to blood flow starting from the aorta, ending in the right atrium. So, in essence, our heart has to generate sufficient pressure in order to overcome this systemic vascular resistance so that blood can circulate. That makes sense, does it? Well, turns out, as you know, that you don't need the same amount of blood to deliver to your tissues now when you're sitting, or if I actually run here with a knife and start chasing you around. Which I'll, of course, never do. But I was hoping to wake someone up. Unsuccessfully, though. So, the thing is, obviously, that there is need, constant need for adjustments. If someone is sleeping and dreaming, there may be more need for blood flow to certain parts of the brain. Or if someone is sleeping without dreaming, brain may not need as much blood flow. Or however you want to say it, whatever you do, you actually constantly adjust. System constantly changes in order to adjust the blood flow to appropriate level. So this is the key formula and key way of thinking, critical thinking of when you're thinking of what is happening when the blood is flowing. So mean arterial pressure is essentially product of cardiac output and systemic vascular resistance. Remember when I said that arteries are high pressure, low volume reservoir? This is pretty much regulated on arterial side. Systemic vascular resistance is actually regulated through this, as you can appreciate. This is the formula for resistance. If I actually took this away, this would be Poisson's formula for resistance, and you can see that radius is the critical thing. So most of this resistance is regulated on arterial side, and most of it is actually regulated on arterioles. And how is it regulated? Well, there are several different ways how arterioles regulate. They're regulated through local mechanisms by myogenic autoregulation, local metabolic regulation, or local inflammatory factors can actually regulate flow in a particular tissue through particular arteriole. So if in a particular capillary bed you're making a lot of work, so you're generating a lot of CO2, you're going to be dilating those arterioles and actually claiming more blood. So local factors are right here. So every tissue in your body actually can regulate its own blood flow through these local mechanisms. Not every tissue has actually myogenic autoregulation. Kidneys, for example, do, because actually kidneys prefer to have steady flow and steady filtration. Because of that, they actually have this myogenic autoregulation, a few other tissues as well. But all of this is essentially done pretty much locally. Tissues take what they need. However, problem arises if you, for some reason, start bleeding and mean arterial pressure starts dropping, or for whatever reason tissues start taking too much blood. Let's say muscles start taking too much blood. What's going to happen with your blood flow to the brain? It's going to drop. Because heart actually pumped what it pumped, and all of a sudden muscle says, oh, I need blood. And then brain says, wait a second, just a moment. I got my own helpers here. Sympathetic tone. Sympathetic nervous system is very quick to essentially make sure that brain does not get ever without the blood. And interestingly enough, you're going to see alpha-1 adrenergic receptors are those that constrict arterioles, which actually means they're going to stop blood flow to particular arterial beds. And if I actually stop blood flow to my gut and to my muscles, there's going to be more blood left to go to my brain. Curiously enough, as you would predict, brain arterioles do not have innervation by sympathetic nervous system. Now, why would that be? Yes?
Your example of chasing somebody with a knife is a short-term kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
But what about something that's more longer-term, like the example of a world-class athlete like Lance Armstrong?
You really want to use Lance? In his case, erythropoietin. Just kidding.
But I'd always heard that he has, internally, his whole system for pumping blood is essentially different from that of a normal human being. That his arteries are larger and that he has the capacity of delivering more blood to his legs than a normal person. Would that be true for somebody who's at work?
Well, okay, so this is a very interesting question, and I'm going to try to be brief. So we are all different genetically from each other, thankfully. So some people are great athletes like Lance Armstrong, with or without erythropoietin. Some people are not so great athletes as yours truly. Even though, for those who want to later stay on, I'm going to tell you a funny story from my medical school. So the thing is, it is very, very likely that one succeeds in a particular athletic discipline and event unless they use some, helping things. Because their particular physiology is such that allows that. Allows more efficient delivery of the blood to particular muscles. That's quite possible. I'll share some, darn HIPAA. I'll share my data with you. So my hemoglobin values are actually on the upper border of the normal, which means that I actually can deal with a lot of issues when oxygen is not that highly present. So could I be a very good athlete in some sport because of that? Perhaps. So that's the answer. It's quite likely and quite possible, and that's actually the answer why someone is actually really good athlete and someone else is less good athlete. My son, for example, is a wonderful guitar player. But not very good athlete. Draws beautifully. Good at math, but not very good runner. And I don't even want to give him a baseball bat. So, does this make sense? The beautiful thing is actually that we all are different. And not to go there, but think about combination of that, of those genes. Long live love, we're in San Francisco. Okay. So does this make sense, guys, for the brain? This is essentially what the brain does. Regulates systemic vascular resistance, but with the goal to actually make sure that it takes whatever it needs. Through sympathetic system and the hormones. Sympathetic system acts much faster, hormones act a little bit slower, and then there are a few other things that can be done if a person is bleeding or if someone is an athlete and actually needs to mobilize blood from other sources. So, arterioles are the site where the dysregulation of systemic vascular resistance really occurs. This is not the only place where you have resistance, but this is where you regulate the resistance. And that's where the greatest pressure drop occurs, meaning that arterioles actually have the greatest resistance on their own anyways. So if I were to show you actually pressure drop from left ventricle to aorta and larger arteries to arterioles and then down to capillaries, take a look at this. This is drop in your arterioles. So most of the essentially work that heart does is done to overcome the resistance in the arterioles. And actually, this is a perfect, it makes kind of a perfect sense because arterioles are the last station before the capillaries. And arterioles actually regulate what gets into capillaries. And if some particular tissue is not working very hard, doesn't need that much blood, that arteriole can actually stay tight, shut. And there are even something called precapillary sphincters, which essentially just completely shut down blood flow to a particular capillary bed. Beautiful system. But you can actually open it up if you need. So do you see that? Another thing that actually you can see, you see those oscillations in the pressure with that black line. Do you see by the time we get close to the capillaries that the oscillations have ceased completely? The pressure is steady. Drops, but steadily. And that's actually quite important for the exchange in the capillaries. This is the same figure just for the lungs. You can see the pressures in the lungs are much smaller and oscillations are last quite even through the capillaries. So the lungs are entirely different beast, although for the most practical purposes very similar to the systemic circulation. So arterioles regulate which capillary beds get perfused and how much. So this is just simple drawing that I did just to illustrate this to you. Do you see these things here, right? They're like little screws. So if I screw this screw on this arteriole, I've actually eliminated blood flow through this capillary bed, which means that more blood is going to be left to go to these other capillary beds. Makes sense, does it? So that's, in essence, what happens with arteriolar regulation of blood flow. There are local mechanisms that we just mentioned in that big slide. I'm going to come back to this because actually I think that this is sort of important. And systemic regulation of resistance. Local mechanisms are autoregulation, in which you, for example, have... You will appreciate that if the pressure goes up, what happens with the flow? Increases or decreases? Excellent. So if you increase pressure, flow increases. But if you want to have a system in which you want to keep the flow steady, what do you want to do if the pressure increases? You want to increase resistance to keep the flow steady. So this is that autoregulation, myogenic autoregulation. There are some blood vessels like arterioles and kidney that actually, if they sense the pressure increase, calcium rushes into those, there are these mechanoreceptors, calcium rushes into those blood vessels and start constricting them, increasing resistance so that flow goes back to normal. Beautiful system. So that's one way of local regulation. Second kind of local regulation is this metabolic regulation. Metabolic regulation is found in every system of the body. What is the metabolic regulation doing? So this is what we already mentioned. If a particular capillaries are being inundated with carbon dioxide, your CO2 is actually a product of what? Of cellular respiration, of essentially meaning your cells are working hard. That means that metabolism is amped up. So you have a lot of CO2. If you have a lot of CO2, increase in CO2 in a particular capillary bed is actually going to cause arteriolar relaxation, drop in arteriolar resistance. Pretty cool system. Wouldn't you say so? Drop in ATP is going to do the same thing. On the other hand, if your oxygen goes up for some reason, that is a signal to the arterioles that I have too much of a good thing. Let's not overdo it. Let's squeeze those arterioles a little bit and let other things, other places have fun with oxygen. So metabolic regulation, actually, there are a number of metabolic regulators. In muscles, it's actually extracellular potassium as well. I just want to sort of point out this to you, not spend too much time on it. And then there is actually locally released messengers, such as NO, nitrous oxide, or histamine. We are all familiar with histamine. Local inflammatory, released from basophils, essentially, vasodilation. So there are locally released messengers that are actually, sometimes people call them, that are paracrines that have local concerns, that want actually blood to get into that particular bed and to increase flow to that particular bed. Why would actually that happen? Typically, you know, if you have some kind of inflammation in a particular tissue, that's what you want to do. Why would you want to do, if you have inflammation in particular tissue, blood flow to that tissue to increase? Any guesses? Yes? To increase the number of immune cells that can get there. Exactly. Exactly. Monocytes. T cells, to increase number of immune cells that are going to get to that particular... Yes?
Do pyrogens affect the regulation? Wait, do pyrogens affect the resistance or the...
Paracrines?
Pyrogens.
Pyrogens, do they affect the resistance? Pyrogens actually typically act centrally in hypothalamus to actually readjust your body temperature.
Okay.
Yes.
It also involves prostaglandins.
It will involve prostaglandins. It will involve thromboxanes. It will involve prostacyclines. Tons of local mediators. Endothelins, actually, which are extremely potent vasoconstrictors. So, bunch of different molecules that actually do these local concern thing. Does it make sense, guys? And then we have systemic regulation is SANS, sympathetic autonomic nervous system with alpha 1 constricting and beta 2 relaxing. And you're going to ask me, well, why would the sympathetic nervous system want to relax anything if it's concerned with the brain? Anybody has an idea? Any idea?
Beta blockers? For like anxiety, that sort of thing?
For anxiety, this... not really. Not for anxiety here.
To make it smooth.
To make it...
smooth.
To make it smooth. That's an interesting thing, actually. I mean, to make it... to flow smoother. Interesting thing, not quite so. But an interesting idea. Let me ask you this. What is your brain going to be worth to you if the lion chases you and actually takes a big chunk of your gluteus maximus and you bleed to death? Not much use for a brain, huh? So, sympathetic nervous system through beta 2 receptor will actually help muscles that are working use these local mediators to relax. To relax arterioles and take as much blood as they need while they are working. But the only muscles that are working, because this is not very, very strong relaxation. If you are just left to sympathetic nervous system, everything is going to be shut down. But if you start running or fighting someone, beta 2 helps actually so that muscles can actually take that blood. Another very interesting thing, actually, this is going back to something else entirely. When we are running away from danger, how do we feel? Or when we are fighting someone?
Anxiety.
Anxiety, scared. But why is it that there are these people, actually, that want to do these activities that are anxiety-inducing? These adrenaline junkies. Are there any adrenaline junkies here? There are. Why do you want to do it?
I think it becomes almost an addictive behavior.
Yeah, but why would it be addictive? There must be something good about it. You must feel some. Do you feel good when you do that?
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
It releases endorphins.
It releases endorphins, exactly. It does. And why would that release endorphins on her?
So that you can act.
So that you can believe, yeah, that's a lion, but boy, am I strong. I am going to twist that neck in a second, and there won't be any lion anymore. So you need to believe that you actually will be successful, either in escaping or winning the fight. Okay. Parasympathetic nervous system has minor role, and circulating hormones actually can both dilate and constrict depending on what the needs are. So this is actually how the whole system is regulating it. Remember when we talked about the heart, we said actually that calcium is free calcium in cytoplasm is determining the strength of the contraction of the heart muscle. The same story in the smooth muscle. These blood vessels actually have a smooth muscle that constricts. Same story, calcium. The players are slightly different. You also have these myosin heads that actually bind to actin, and there's this ratchet head motion. However, the whole system is slightly different because it has this something thing called myosin light chain kinase. So calcium comes in, and this alpha-1 adrenergic receptor actually increases calcium intercellularly to cause constriction. This calcium actually binds to calmodulin and essentially opens up active site on calmodulin, and then that calmodulin MLCK complex phosphorylates your inactive myosin. And once it's phosphorylated, you see those two P's? Now it can bind to actin and cause contraction. There's something called myosin light chain phosphorylase, and beta-2 receptor actually activates this phosphorylase, which removes these phosphates and inactivates contraction. So that's what beta-2 adrenergic receptor does. One thing that I want to tell you now about arteries and arterioles is to remind you of this that actually Betty showed you. Remember that figure? This is actually a generic blood vessel. It has endothelium, it has smooth muscles, it has connective tissue on the outside. So this is the thing. The thing is that arteries and arterioles, but particularly arteries, are exposed to high pressure. And high pressure causes shear forces that damage the endothelium. And damage to endothelium can be actually quite bad. One of the problems with having very high pressure is actually the higher the pressure, the more shear forces of your endothelium, the more damage to endothelium cells, and the more problems that can incur. So what happens is, you see these LDL little molecules? If you couple high blood pressure with high cholesterol level, you actually have a perfect storm. What happens is actually that damage to endothelial cells opens up these little holes in which LDL can go in underneath the endothelial cells. And we get something called fatty streak. And then that LDL actually gets oxidized typically. And some immune system cells, innate immune system, can actually recognize oxidized LDL, oxidized fat on LDL. That oxidized fat turns out looks a lot like sort of generic bacteria, which activates immune system. And it starts attracting macrophages, monocytes, which become tissue macrophages, which then eat up that LDL because they think actually that they're eating bacteria. Little do they know. And they actually release a bunch of other immune mediators which actually convert smooth muscles into phagocytic cells that too start eating LDL. And this keeps growing and growing, and then actually you essentially start pushing through the endothelial cells. And you form thrombus. And that thrombus can actually break off. And since it's in arteries, if it breaks off and flows downstream, what's happening with the caliber of the arteries as you go downstream? Gets smaller. And what happens with the thrombus? Gets stuck. That is what happens actually most typically in your myocardial infarction. You have this kind of process in your coronary arteries. Thrombus forms and becomes thromboembolus as it breaks off, and essentially you have an MI. So that's something that I wanted just to tell you. High pressure, high cholesterol, not a bad companions. That is not to say that high pressure on its own is not bad. Because of these shear forces, you can actually have damage to some blood vessels in the brain. Particularly, people think there are particularly these blood vessels that get off of the main vessel on the right angle. And under those conditions, shear forces are the highest. And even a small blood vessel that is damaged in the brain, you can have a stroke that can make you paralyzed if it's in particular part, or you can't speak. And you don't have to have a really big stroke. So this high pressure, the fact that arteries are operating in the high pressure, it's actually really a danger. What about capillaries? This is a beautiful scanning an electron microscope of the heart muscle capillary. Don't you think it's pretty?
Oh, yeah.
Look at that. Thanks to Dennis Kunkel in Astrographics. This is a little bit less pretty, but I just wanted to show you what happens to red blood cells as they are squeezed through capillaries. Take a look at that. This is one of the illustrations why sickle cell anemia is actually dangerous. In sickle cell anemia, you change hemoglobin and your red blood cells are not this malleable anymore. They break up much more easy. So this is actually what happens normally under normal conditions with your red blood cells. They're very malleable, very easy to squeeze to capillaries. One thing that is not quite visible here, and unfortunately what I wanted to show you is cross-sectional area in square centimeters. As you go from the aorta to the capillaries, and this is the lung capillaries, this is systemic capillaries. Do you see how the cross-sectional area, total area, meaning if you actually add all the vessels of the same type on top of each other and then look cross-section of all of those, take a look at cross-section of all the capillaries. 3,000 square centimeters. Huge cross-sectional area. Which is kind of, if you think about resistance, think of the radius of that cross-sectional area, what would you say this total resistance of the capillaries is? Very large or very low? Very low. Because they are all in parallel. So you can essentially treat them like that. So take a look at blood velocity in the capillaries. Very, very slow. So low resistance and slow flow. So capillaries have interesting physical properties. I think actually Betty was probably telling you a little bit about it. There are generally three different types of capillaries. You have essentially continuous capillary, which is all of these endothelial cells. And capillaries only have endothelial cells in their wall and basement membrane, nothing else. So that the exchange can be done efficiently. So this is continuous capillary, just endothelial cells attached to each other. Brain would have this and would have some other things as well, in addition to actually protect the blood-brain barrier. This is fenestrated capillary. You see these little holes? Fenestre. Fenestra is window in Latin. So these are windowed capillaries. So they have actually holes so more things can go easily through them. Typical capillary like this is in kidney. Or sinusoidal, completely discontinuous capillary, large fenestrations and gaps between the individual endothelial cells, typically found in liver. And as you know, liver synthesizes a lot of proteins and takes a lot of other stuff from the blood, so it has to actually be able to take up large things. So that's hence these large holes. So interesting thing about properties of the capillaries is that they have large surface to volume ratio, which means that any place in the capillary you are, you're close to the surface of the capillary. Why would that be useful? For exchange. Exactly. So even if you're in the middle of the capillary, you're not far from the surface of the capillary. And then large total cross-section surface, which actually causes slow flow. Another thing that you really want if you want to exchange things between the capillaries and tissues. How much would you be... It's like thinking, you know... Sort of an analogy would be actually trying to get on the bus that actually drives 20 miles per hour, get on and off the bus. As opposed to bus that actually slows down and goes, let's say, 1 mile per hour. Now that you could do. Would you agree? So that's the same principle here. And they have thin, leaky walls in order to enable exchange, to facilitate it. So how do different substances move across the capillary walls? Two main principles of moving. Diffusion. And filtration. There's also this thing on the bottom here, pinocytosis, which essentially means that endothelial cells kind of take some globe of stuff and kind of pinch their membrane and then move the whole globe of membrane on the other side and actually move it. But this is not the most common way of moving things across the capillary walls. So diffusion and filtration. So if we think about diffusion, this is a major way of nutrient and waste exchange. All the gases, CO2, O2, diffusion, pretty much. Rate of diffusion is going to depend on permeability of the membrane for the particular molecule that is diffusing. Concentration gradient, meaning if it's higher on one side than on the other, it's going to be down its concentration gradient. And the larger the concentration gradient, the larger the diffusion rate. And surface area available. And as we already said, capillaries have actually very large surface area. What about filtration? Filtration actually describes bulk movement of water and its content between the interstitium and plasma, or plasma and interstitium. There are water pores in the cells. Aquaporins are the channels that actually can allow water to go, and things that are dissolved in water can also go. In capillaries such as we've seen, the fenestrated capillaries or sinusoidal capillaries, that bulk flow is obviously going to be very, very large, if you will. Filtration depends on permeability to water and net pressure gradient. And actually, if I were to write the formula for that, it would look something like this. Q of F, filtrational flow, is going to depend on coefficient of filtration times delta P, which is the pressure gradient. This is actually typically how physiologists go about it, although this thing is nothing else but inverse of resistance. So you could actually say that QF is actually proportional to pressure gradient and inversely proportional to resistance to flow across the wall of the capillary. that makes sense, does it? There are a few things actually that go into this. We would say actually the size, the length of the pore of the through which the water flows, the viscosity, and which are essentially all those things that are in the formula for resistance. So I'm going to actually skip this and just tell you that turns out. I'm not going to skip it. I'm just going to draw it. Let's say we have actually capillary, which is simple drawing of a capillary. This is arteriolar end, and this is venular end of the capillary. So what typically happens is actually that you're at the arteriolar end, you have net filtration, meaning net fluid is leaving capillary, and on the venular end, you have net absorption. Because you filtered a lot of fluid here, by the time you get here, you have lost fluid, so you pick up fluid on the other end. Kind of simple thing. I'm not going to go into details. One thing that helps somewhat is actually with this is the fact that we have a lot of proteins inside of the capillary. Does anybody know what osmotic pressure is? You know what osmotic pressure is, so I'm not going to actually go into explanation of osmotic pressure. This is a special case of osmotic pressure called colloid oncotic pressure, which is due to the proteins. Now, typically when we talk about osmotic pressure, we talk about some solutes in some fluid. These solutes are actually proteins that can't cross the capillary. And they are essentially trying to hold on to the water. And they're one of the main reasons why, essentially, once you got rid of fluid here, you reabsorb fluid here. Turns out that actually we filter a little bit more than we reabsorb. All of our capillaries filter a little bit more than they reabsorb. Do you see a problem with that, guys? Yes?
The lymphatic system.
Aha. That's where the lymphatic system comes in. Because we filter a tiny little bit more than we absorb. If we kept filtering a little bit more than we absorb, we would essentially soon enough be walking balloons. Because tissue would be actually being edematous. But lymphatic system is actually taking care of that extra fluid that is not picked up by the capillaries, returns it back into superior vena cava. I believe actually Betty was talking to you about it. And lymphatic system is beautiful. This is actually one very nice cross-sectional microscopic picture of a single lymph vessel. You can see they have valves. Very nice. And have tiny little smooth muscle cells that are actually like rings that squeeze and push lymph up towards the vena cava superior. So if there is a problem with either capillaries or lymphatic system, we will end up with edema. Or if there is a problem with the heart. So if you increase capillary blood pressure, you're going to be favoring filtration. If you favor filtration, you're going to be favoring edema. If you increase capillary leakiness, you're going to also cause edema. Typically, most typically, increasing capillary blood pressure is going to occur when you have failing heart. So if the heart can't pump properly, if the pump is failing, blood backs up behind it, which actually then means that venous pressure increases, which means that venular pressure increases, which means capillary pressure increases, and you can actually leak from the both venules and the capillaries, and you have edema. If it's left heart problem, you're going to have pulmonary edema. If it's right heart problem, you're going to have edema in systemic circulation, just as we said last time. Remember that? Okay. What can increase capillary leakiness? Inflammation. Inflammation does it on purpose. As we said, to allow immune cells to go where they can actually act, where they need to act. Or tissue damage, burns, can also increase capillary leakiness. veins. So veins are high volume, low pressure reservoir. At any given time, there's approximately 66%, two-thirds of the blood are sitting in the veins. They're obviously, compared to arteries, high volume reservoir. And they're a low pressure reservoir, because essentially pressure on the venous size is quite low. You would appreciate that as well. Well, because you have so much blood in the veins, you can actually mobilize that blood from the veins if you need to increase your cardiac output. So essentially, you squeeze your veins and push a little bit more blood to your heart, and that heart then pumps that extra blood, which is a beautiful concept. The problem with arteries, as we said, is actually it's high pressures, damage to endothelial cells, and then all these other things that can come in. On the venous side, actually, problem is actually that the low pressure and slow flow can actually create the problem on their own. If you add on top of it some issue or a problem with venous wall, so that you have essentially varicose veins, the flow becomes even slower. So if you have blood that is flowing very slowly, what do you think is going to be happening? Clotting. You need normal flow of blood to avoid clotting as well. As a survivor of one of those clots, actually myself, I've had portal vein thrombosis of all things, which is a vein that takes the blood from the gut into your liver. I have no idea why I actually ended up with it, but essentially, you are at risk of thrombosis in your veins if you are actually, because of this slow flow. That's why, for example, if you're traveling on the plane, traveling to Europe or Australia, the flight attendants are going to tell you, please get up, exercise, do something, move your legs. Because muscles actually serve as the venous pump as well. Help to pump the blood so that essentially you decrease likelihood of those blood stasis. Because blood, when it stands, it tends to clot. Remember last time when we were talking about heart and talked about atrial fibrillation? Atria that fibrillate can't contract, they just do this. That also causes the essentially slowing of blood flow, which actually causes a problem of thrombosis as well. Veins regulate cardiac filling through something we call in physiology venous return. How is that done? Well, if you take a closer look at the smooth muscle, you're going to see that veins have smooth muscle too, particularly larger veins. And that smooth muscle is innervated also by alpha-1 adrenergic receptor, that same sympathetic receptor that can constrict arterioles can constrict veins. So if I squeeze veins, what do you think is going to happen with pressure in the veins? Increase. If I increase the pressure in the veins, what's going to happen with the flow? It's going to increase. And it's going to go where? To capillaries? No. Where is it going to go? To the heart, to the area where the pressure is lowest. So that is actually what sympathetic nervous system does when it wants to mobilize venous blood and actually add more blood to the heart to pump. And it turns out that up to a certain level, heart is going to pump whatever you bring to it. So essentially, this is called Frank Starling's law. But essentially, heart pumps, stretches more, pumps more. So sympathetic nervous system can increase venous return, which is going to then increase what your heart pumps. So if I were to show you what would happen here, I squeeze veins here, and this actually increases blood delivery to the heart. Through alpha-1 adrenergic receptor. So, going back to demands for perfusion change and how does the system adjust? We've seen this one before, and we've seen this whole side before. Remember? This occurs on the arterial side, particularly arterioles. We didn't talk about cardiac output. How is cardiac output regulated? Well, cardiac output is regulated thus. It's product of stroke volume, which is actually volume of blood that heart pumps in a single cardiac cycle. When it squeezes once, it pumps a certain amount of blood. That blood that gets into our aorta is called stroke volume. If you multiply it by heart rate, you're going to get cardiac output. Volume per unit of time. Makes sense. And now it turns out that these two things are actually regulated, stroke volume and heart rate. Heart rate, as you remember last time we talked about, is regulated by sympathetic and parasympathetic system. Sympathetic, beta 1, is going to increase heart rate. Parasympathetic, through muscarinic M2, decreases heart rate. What about stroke volume? What regulates stroke volume? Stroke volume is regulated by preload, which is a fancy name for the venous return. Preload really means the blood that returns to the heart from the veins. So through alpha-1 adrenergic system that we actually just mentioned, when it squeezes veins, it's going to actually squeeze the blood towards the heart. You're going to increase the stroke volume because more blood is going to get in the heart and more blood is going to be available to be pumped. Afterload is actually a term that is used in physiology to describe all the forces that are opposing the pumping of the heart. For example, it could be high blood pressure or aortic stenosis. So afterload is essentially opposing the pumping of the heart. And then contractility. Contractility is a term that describes really the contractile strength of the heart. How strong heart contracts. And that is also regulated, if you remember, last time when we talked about the heart, by beta-1 adrenergic receptor. So these three things regulate stroke volume. How much blood is brought by veins to the heart? How strongly heart contracts through beta-1 receptor? And what kind of force heart has to overcome in order to dump this blood into the aorta. So you can imagine problems that could arise at any of these points, can you? Okay. If we are matching supply and demand, what we are doing essentially, we have to maintain the constant arterial pressure in order to assure that supply is matching the demand. So, some change in arterial pressure is going to actually be reported to the brain. And brain, as a central regulator, is going to say, okay, we have a problem here, and it's going to actually issue command to the sympathetic autonomic nervous system to change arterial resistance, to change the heart rate, to change the contractility, to change the venous return. So all of these things are adjusted through sympathetic nervous system very rapidly and sometimes through hormones if need be. Let's say one specific example. Increased demand in a particular tissue causes these local mediators, metabolic mediators, essentially cause vasodilation in particular arterioles. So some tissue draws more blood. You can appreciate that. That is going to actually decrease resistance and increase the flow in that particular tissue. That is going to decrease mean arterial pressure because all of a sudden resistance in a particular capillary bed dropped quite significantly, so that capillary bed draws much more blood than it used to draw. Does it make sense? Which drops mean arterial pressure. Now, decreased mean arterial pressure is going to be essentially requiring increase in cardiac output because mean arterial pressure is measured and then heart does all of the central nervous system does all of these things to adjust cardiac output in order to keep the mean arterial pressure the same so that brain can get what it needs. So we're going to have increased supply to match demand, and essentially mean arterial pressure returns to normal. So this is what we were talking about when Bill said actually we were talking about reflex loops. This is how it works. If you actually have decrease in tissue demand, you will have exactly the opposite. This is essentially, in essence, a negative feedback loop. Feedback loop means. Okay. So, imagine this situation. What would be the best analog? Let's say my blood pressure has to be mean arterial pressure 90. And all of a sudden, I start working out, my muscles demand more blood, pressure, mean arterial pressure drops. Do you see that?
Why does it drop?
Because the muscles that you didn't work moments ago all of a sudden are working and are drawing more blood. So they're taking away more blood, which is going to cause the pressure to drop. That is measured, and brain says, oh, mean arterial pressure dropped. And how do I know that? Because I'm getting woozy. So then brain actually activates the sympathetic nervous system to actually mobilize more blood from the veins, squeeze arterioles in the places where the blood is not needed, like gut. If you're working out, your gut really doesn't need blood. So it returns pressure back to 90. So do you see how this is called a negative feedback loop? Because essentially, if the pressure drops, goes in one direction, system returns it back in the other direction. That's why it's called negative. Positive feedback loop will actually, so, oh, you dropped. I'm going to make you drop even more. Not really homeostatic. Yes?
Is that control done chemically rather than with a nervous electrical impulse?
I'll show you now. Baroreceptors actually monitor arterial pressure. They are found in carotid artery and aortic arch. These turn out to be a little bit more important in human carotid baroreceptors. They go to 9th cranial nerve, report to the brain, particular part of the brain stem, and actually measure essentially how much the wall of the carotid is stretched. Stretch of the wall is going to correspond to pressure inside of the vessel, obviously. Would you agree? This is how they work. So this is aortic pressure going up and down, as we have seen before. These are three cycles. And these are three different mean arterial pressures. And this is these little red lines are compressed action potentials that are essentially occurring in these nerves that are reporting to the brain what's happening for mean arterial pressure. So 75 millimeters of mercury, if you're recording actually and connected it to the speaker, you could actually record something that looks like, sounds like, the pressure, mean arterial pressure increases to 100 millimeters of mercury, or 125, now this is really high, very high activity in your baroreceptors. So that is actually being essentially recorded. Turns out that baroreceptors are most sensitive in a healthy person within the normal range. So this is actually indicating sensitivity of the baroreceptor. If you move a little bit away from the normal range, they change activity a lot. If you move a lot away from normal activity, then you get into their saturation. Now, the question is, again, why would anybody have high blood pressure if baroreceptors are keeping tab on this, what's going on? And the answer is actually that baroreceptors, after some time, if you actually keep pushing them and keep saying, okay, not 90, 120, Not 90, 120. And then baroreceptors say, okay, ego really wants to be 120. And then they start regulating here. And that's actually why it's hard to actually deal with regulation of blood pressure. So this is actually drawing of the baroreceptor reflex. If the pressure increases, this red line here is showing baroreceptor neuron that is going to be reporting in a particular nucleus in the midbrain, that actually then, if the pressure increases, what you want to do? What do you want to do with the sympathetic system if the pressure gets too high? Inhibit sympathetic system or make it fire high more? Inhibit sympathetic system, because sympathetic system actually, when activated, rises the blood pressure. So inhibit sympathetic nervous system, so you see those negative signs here, and stimulate parasympathetic nervous system. So you're going to slow down the heart and relax blood vessels. Makes sense, does it? How do we actually deal with long-term matching flow to metabolism? If your muscles grow, you better grow some blood vessels to deliver this extra blood. The problem is actually that when with those growths that we don't want, such as tumors, actually, one of the very, very, very important areas of investigation in tumor biology is angiogenesis in tumors. What else we can do actually to increase the blood delivery? A heart can hypertrophy. It can hypertrophy to increase stroke volume and cardiac output. However, that hypertrophy may be detrimental. If you actually hypertrophy your heart too much, it may actually outstrip its own blood supply. And you can actually end up with fibrosis and heart failure. So I was hoping that we were going to have time for some cases that I would see what you would want to do, but apparently it's 8:30, we don't have time for that. Sorry. This is where it actually ends.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.